name is Bob Hurst. I'm the general editor of the Mark Twain Project, and I'm here to talk to George and Sally.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Very glad to do it.
So, if I might ask you personally first, when did your own interest in Mark Twain begin?
Well, the serious interest, the kind that you might remember, probably began in college. I mean, I was asked to write a paper about Huckleberry Finn, and I did, and that seemed very interesting. But I suppose the real beginning was when I took a seminar with Henry Nash Smith here in graduate school. He conducted the seminar in the papers, and one of the assignments was to take 10 or 12 pages of one of Mark Twain's notebooks and annotate it, explain what was, you know, what was in it.
Yeah.
Not the original notebook. I mean, it's a typed copy of it, but still, that was quite a lot of fun. And basically, you got turned loose into the archive and learned how to kind of find things that needed explanation and then explain them.
Sort of like being a private investigator.
Well, very much so. I mean, it was, you know, it appealed to a graduate student like me who basically was not too happy with the ideology of the English department at that
right.
time. Or even not. For that
right.
matter. So this was, as far as I was concerned, real work. You're actually trying to find out what happened or what Mark Twain meant.
Yeah.
Things that, in general, you know, are looked down upon now as impossible. You can't know what happened in the past.
Yeah.
So you might as well ignore it.
Now, do you, even after all of these decades, do you ever get surprised with something
new?
Oh,
every day.
Yeah?
Every day. I mean, one of the amazing things about it is even though there are all these papers here that he put together and gave to his, well, put in the hands of his official biographer, and then they were transmitted by a long process out here, was, you know, his core private archive, including, you know, 17,000 letters to him and his notebooks and his autobiography, that kind of thing. Even though that has been here since 1949, new things that were not in the papers have been added continuously since then.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they come from everywhere. They come, well, of course, his letters go out into the world, and for good reasons people save them.
Mm-hmm.
And we are still finding, in one way or another, three new letters a week.
A week? A week?
Yeah, that's gone up from two a week and from one a week because the electronic world has changed your ability to find things. So, I mean, one of my colleagues came down to me the other day and said, I just found 20 letters. I said, where did you find 20 letters? Oh, in Belgium, she said.
Wow.
In Belgium? She gave her the name of the library, which I can't even remember. And I said, how the hell did you find that? She said, well, they just decided to put their catalog up online, so when I'm searching, up they come.
And there it was.
Yeah. And we also, a lot of newspapers are now digitized in a fairly
right.
rough and ready way, but still searchable.
Right.
And, you know, it turns out the people who had Mark Twain letters tended to kind of give them to the newspaper
yeah.
and let them, you know, publish them. So the number of letters that have, you know, per week on average that's showing up has gone up. And I don't expect it to go down anytime soon.
How large is the collection?
Well, that's a little hard to say because no one's ever really done a count. But I've gotten used to saying there are at least 500,000 pages of manuscript here. If you include the letters that were written to him, if you include the autobiography, his notebooks, the several hundred literary manuscripts, some of them quite long, some of them very short. And certainly if you include all of the copies of things that we've acquired over the years, because, I mean, there are lots of libraries that own Mark Twain letters.
Mm-hmm.
We try to get a copy of everything that we know about so that you can come here and simply read anything by Mark Twain
right.
in whatever period you want. So certainly it's 500,000 if you include all of those. I would say it's probably close to 500,000 even if you don't. And I'm not talking about, you know, some of his books from his library or a couple of his memento photographs and
right.
the first daguerreotype of him.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you count those? They're not really.
Yeah.
So it's big. And I mean, certainly compared to any other American writer of the 19th century, none of them put together or allowed to be put together this kind of very telltale assemblage of documents. I mean, for instance, he keeps all of his bills and checks and things. So you can go into 1874 and find how much beer he drank, you know, how much he paid for wood, you know, to burn. So,
right.
I mean, in a way, I've said that.
And he kept those in his autobiography. He kept their lists of many of those things.
Lots of things. Well, he's the kind of guy who doesn't throw stuff away.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the thing is, there are certainly gaps. There are certainly things he did throw away.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that if this is a very revealing kind of thing to leave behind you, and it's very much like the autobiography in the sense that it tells the truth about you without your, intending it to tell the truth. You didn't create the bills. You didn't create those letters for the purpose of influencing someone down the line. You created them for the immediate purpose, and that's why you want letters that haven't been censored by the family or, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I would say that, if you compare him to someone like Henry James or Willa Cather, both of whom gave instructions to their correspondents to burn their letters. Now, many people didn't,
right.
but and there's still thousands of James letters. I don't know how many her letters there are, but the fact is, this is a rare thing. Either the relative collections are very much smaller, or they don't exist at all. Melville didn't keep any archive, but things have gradually assembled. You can put all of Melville's letters in a single volume.
Mm-hmm.
It'd take 25 volumes to put all of Mark Twain's letters in. So, and then you wouldn't have them all.
Yeah.
We have record of some text of about 10,000 letters. And we're sure he wrote 50,000 letters, easily. And so, that would be something, that would be one thing if it was just, I can't come to tea or whatever. Or no, sometimes
right.
he does.
Right. Yeah.
But they're not like that. He can't resist opening up and talking to people about things that interest them, and he's often very amusing. And frankly, when he doesn't answer the letter, you'll often take the letter that he's gotten and write on the envelope, "Damn fool," or "No answer." "The idiots are mighty thick this season," he said.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's
a good one.
There are a lot of them. When I talk about Mark Twain, I sort of bring some of those out because they're not things that we would ordinarily publish. Where are they going to go, But they tell you a lot about Mark Twain. Here he is sitting, getting all this mail, most of which he doesn't really want to have to deal with, all kinds of, requests for autographs, for money, for help.
Well, he was basically the world's first superstar.
That is correct. And people knew that.
This is Mick Jagger.
They write to him for all kinds of help. And, he can be extremely acidic and nasty. And so what you see on these envelopes is the nastiness put down in very brief form, but no answer. In other words, he's too tender-hearted to actually say that.
Yeah.
Or he'll get a letter. I'm just thinking one in which he was asked for advice by a woman who was a poet and novelist, and she wanted advice getting published. And he wrote her back a letter, which we don't have, but a letter which he says basically told her as nice a way as possible that she didn't have any talent and that she wouldn't, she shouldn't. And she writes him again and says, you could help me do this. And he threats on the envelope, "I tried to let her down easy." He said, "This is a damn result I get." And it just sort of shows you really what his character is like in a way that you're not going to be able to pick up on in other things.
I have to tell you, as an aside, most of the A-list top writers we've spoken with have the same experience today.
Okay.
Manuscripts left on their porches with expectations that you're going to read and edit my first-time novel about.
Yeah.
Oh.
It happens to Mark Twain throughout his public career, and he actually writes several pieces about it. But I'm sure it's not an uncommon thing.
Yeah. Could you just discuss quickly what you know of how he began as a writer, what his influence was, or what prompted him to begin telling stories?
Well, I think the telling stories must go back very earlier than any documents that we have. And so you're sort of relying on people's memories of this, but that's a little tricky because they get influenced by what they know of him as But I think you'd be a fair guess to say that his natural inclination, his natural talent for telling stories and for using the language in American English, must have been very early. Okay. And, of course, he realizes, he hated going to school. And so he resisted going to school. And his mother recalls in 1885, she's about 90, I think, that she and her husband couldn't make Sam go regularly to the common school. They tried and tried, and he would always hooky one thing and another. And then, of course, his father dies when he's 11. So she says, well, I just took this moment to kind of really talk to him seriously, and I brought him into the room with the coffin between us and said, now I want to have a very serious conversation with you. And he bursts into tears and says, oh, mother, I'll do anything, except go to school. And so she says, you know, I mean, that was that, and I just couldn't have him running wild, so I had him apprenticed to a printer. And that's where you see the first real influx of things to read comes from. I mean, the printer, even in a small town, is receiving exchanges, newspapers, free newspapers. There's a law that says basically if you send your newspaper to this guy and he sends his to you, they can go through the mails free.
Right.
So little newspapers like this relied on what they're called exchanges. So they're, you know, he's got stacks of exchanges to read, and he's, of course, taught how to set up type. Right? So it becomes a fairly important thing soon on. And we know that really within a year or so of his starting to work for his brother in 1851, he starts writing squibs for the newspaper. And when Orion, that's his older brother who owned the thing, when he goes away to St. Louis for a couple of weeks, Clemens gets in there, writes several things, you know, things that are, you know, pretty tough on the local printer, you know, the guy who's been jilted. He makes just brutal fun of him in a way that was very revealing, I think, of what Clemens must have been like early on. He had a capacity for wounding you with words that he had to learn how to control.
Got him in trouble in Nevada, real serious.
Yeah, I mean, no, it takes a while. It takes a while before he realizes how painful his comments can be. I mean, I always told a story about that when he's engaged to Olivia Langdon. This would be 1869. Mr. Langdon says, you know, we need some references. Nobody around here knows who you are. Charlie does. Charlie's her younger brother, but he doesn't count. So he gives Mr. Langdon the names of three or four ministers out here in San Francisco. Yes. That he has made fun of in print, but considers himself friends, and they write back and say, you know, they'd rather bury a daughter of theirs than have him marry someone like Clemens, and they, you know, they detail his carousing and stuff in San Francisco. The reason that's of interest, among other things, is that he intuitively doesn't grasp that having made fun of these guys, they're not going to be his friends. I mean, they're not going to be his loyal friends at all.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a learning process to learn how to master that, that ability to wound and put it to good service. I mean, after all, it becomes a very important part of all of the good stuff that he wrote.
To your knowledge, was there anyone else at the time writing in the way that he began writing?
Well, we know for a fact that he is conversant with all the Southwest humorists.
Right.
I mean, the evidence I give is there's a diplomat in London in 1873 when Clemens and his wife were there, and he writes down in his journal the conversation that's been had, and he makes the point, you know, that Mark Twain knew this guy Longstreet, not the person, but knew their stuff, remembered their stuff. In other words, he had it at his fingertips. He wasn't, you know, digging a book out. So he has a deep immersion in what we think of as the Southwest humorous tradition. And, you know, when he wants to get his early stuff published, he sends it off to a journal in Boston, something called the Dandy and the Squatter. So he has a sense of newspaper humor out there that he could be part of. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, because it's sort of easy to do for him. He's very funny.
Yeah.
It's easy to do for him, but it's not, you know, it's like third-rate literature. It's not even literature. So for a long while, I mean, really until 1865, until he's almost 30, he puts off deciding to be a writer. I mean, because a humorous writer, he says, you know, it's the one talent, i.e. literature of a low order, i.e. humorous.
Right.
That was something he didn't think he could, you know, achieve a kind of social standing with. That, you know, that's why he's resisting it. But he finally forced to it. And basically, within 20 years, he changes the way in which Americans thought about literary humor. I mean, 20 years is Huckleberry Finn from that, you know. So I think it's interesting that no literary critic that I know has made a plausible argument that Mark Twain's style or his talent is somehow or other derivative of anybody. I mean, at the time, he's known as sui generis, thing unto himself. Yeah. And that's right. I mean, in other words, you know, you can find people who have a similar style, but there's no persuasive evidence that there was an influence, right?
Right.
It's coincidence almost, or maybe he learned something from them, but that he has such a distinctive style of his own that I doubt very much that you can find a source.
And then there's the incredible attention to language, idiomatic phrasing, almost scientific.
Well, I mean, he is deeply interested in the language. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
And he has a capacity for absorbing it and remembering it and using it, which is, it's a landmark. I mean, I often say that the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, has maybe 200 references to Tom Sawyer. But they haven't read anything else. I mean, what they ought to read. They ought to read are the things where, you know, he's telling you what this word means or that word means.
Oh, high-flying esophagus.
Well, I mean, that's a fairly tricky one. I'm trying to think of this one. This is the one they revised the Century Dictionary around 1906. They run across a word in Putnam Wilson and in Yankee, which I'm forgetting at the moment. Yeah. And they write, the header of this thing writes to Clemens and asks him what it means. And he writes back a letter that says, you know, I'm the man, I'm the authority that says that this word meant in Missouri, used by all the male members of Missouri except certain of the clergy, meant this and that and that. And he just rolls it right out. I mean, it's just, and that becomes actually the definition used in the century. I think if you just look at it long enough, you realize that he's fascinated by what the non-standard guys have come up with. And, of course, continued to come up with.
I recall a story in the autobiography of him paying a young boy at a hotel to just talk to him while he took notes on the language, on the pronunciations.
He actually writes something which he throws into the New York Times, which is based on that. I mean, which is basically, you can call it a transcript. It's an artful transcript of what this conversation was all about.
Right.
That occurs early on, about in the 1870-71, when he's on lecture tour. And, you know, there are people like Shelley Fishkin who think that's the beginning of his interest in black dialect, because this kid is clearly black.
Right.
I mean, he's a real kid. We can look him up. You know, we can look up the family. We know how many kids family. We know all about him. But, yes, he, for the rest of his life, actually, anybody who shows up who's got a kind of capacity to keep on talking and talking and talking, he's interested, and he wants any record of that he can get.
Wow.
And you know, when he's corresponding with H.H. Rogers, they both get letters from cranks and, you know, wise sort of odd people out, and he wants to see those.
Yeah.
And that's a collective. He's going to make a book out of them. But really, it has to do with the fact that this naive speaker is very appealing to him, not only because of what he invents, but because of what you can do with him. Yeah, which is what happens in Huck, you see.
Yeah.
I mean, the naive speaker in Huck is Huck, and he, you know, he revolutionizes the way you write novels. I don't know any ways to put it. I mean, that's what Hemingway's talking about. He said, you know, you don't have to speak the way Howells spoke or the way Henry James spoke. You can have a narrator who speaks the vernacular, who is uneducated, and you can do all kinds of things with that. And that's what happened. It's very hard to find a 20th century American writer who does not at some point acknowledge Mark Twain as his source. When I go out and talk about Mark Twain, I basically use things that he's written, you know, 140, 150 years ago. People still laugh. People still laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can tell them over and over again. I'm tempted to go out there and just start quoting Mark Twain just randomly until they stop me. Because, I mean, I'm sure I could do it for an hour.
Okay, do you have... You're on the spot now, Robert.
Oh, yes.
Okay, give us one of your funniest one-liners or stories right now.
Oh, dear, that's hard to
pick. I knew we'd catch you.
Well, no, I mean, there are so many, it's hard to pick. I was just talking back east about a letter that we found fairly recently was published in the Hartford Courant. This is his hometown newspaper, and it's actually an advertisement that says, reward, $205. And it says, in sign, Samuel L. Clemens, and it says, at the baseball meeting on Thursday, while I was hurrahing, a little boy walked off with a good brown silk English umbrella, which belonged to me, and forgot to bring it back. I will give $5 to anyone who returns that umbrella in good condition to my house on Farmington Avenue. I do not want the boy in a living state, but I will pay $200 for his remains.
A joke that you couldn't get away with today.
Of course, I said, you know, not only is it, you know, not, well, why didn't know that he's a baseball fan? He was a baseball fan, but, you know, putting out a contract on this guy in a way that wouldn't seem so funny. But, we don't have any trouble interpreting it. This is the curmudgeon, right?
You know, right.
He wants his umbrella, but he really wants to get that boy.
That's good.
I probably can go on forever more than you want, because there are so many, many stories that last. H.H. Rogers, he's the vice president of Standard Oil, and he's a big friend of Mark Twain. He rescues him from bankruptcy,
times.
In effect. But, of course, at the time, the Standard Oil is coming under a lot of criticism, and Rogers, I guess you'd have to say, he's a robber baron. I mean, he's one of the tough guys before all the protections were passed, before anybody really wrote about the problem. And so this fellow is talking to Mark Twain, and he says, Rogers, your friend Rogers is a good fellow. It's a pity his money is tainted. And sort of without any hesitation or pause or whatever, he says, yeah, it's twice tainted. Taint mine and taint yours. I like that because it's so fast. The way he zeroes in on the envy behind this negative remark and nails it perfectly. I mean, he's not a big punster. He does. He likes puns occasionally. Yeah. But that, I mean, that's, for me, that's a kind of sign of what he was like.
Yeah. As I recall, his long career, prolific career, mm-hmm. involved a number of different writing habits, starting with journalism and starting with Nevada, hanging out in saloons and writing mm-hmm. something in the last 10 mm-hmm. minutes.
Yes, yes.
And then up to writing in the little gazebo on his property. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about some of his actual writing habits?
Well, we know a little bit about them, not a lot.
Right.
Certainly, if you're a journalist in Nevada or in San Francisco, you have to have a capacity for generating copy, and it turns out a very good copy, almost at will. I mean, when he's in San Francisco sort of trying to recover from his debt and really kind of get serious about being a writer, he's writing a 2,000-word letter to the Enterprise from San Francisco every day of the week except Monday. And we know from a few of the letters, and most of these don't survive, but we know from the letters that do survive, these are some of the best things he ever wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So he has that kind of discipline. But it's a discipline that really applies pretty much strictly to something brief. I mean, even these Enterprise letters of 2,000 words contain maybe 4 or 5 separate anecdotes.
Yeah.
And they have the capacity, I mean, they don't have to be connected. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
right.
It can be, he just shifts around and does what he wants to. So when he comes east and decides to make a career as a writer, he gets hooked up with the American Publishing Company, which is a subscription company, and they're in the business of selling big, thick books with lots of illustrations for a lot of money. I mean, they charge $3.50 to $7.50 for them, as opposed to 50 cents, of the ordinary kind.
And selling them door to door.
And selling them door to door, right? Well, he gets locked into that. So, I mean, for instance, Innocence Abroad is easily 650 pages long. How does he manage to make that transition? Well, basically, Innocence Abroad is a collection of brief things. It's the letters that he writes back to the Alta, somewhat revised. It's a trip, and therefore he's licensed to digress whenever he wants to. He's not to worry about the continuity of the trip. It's the continuity. And he sort of eases himself into that problem. And it's really not until his third book, Tom Sawyer, that he's sort of faced with how do you write a fiction
of beginning, this length. Middle, and end.
Yeah, of this length. And, of course, what the kind of fiction that Tom Sawyer is not a beginning, middle, and end. It's a kind of Defoe, you know, picaresque thing. Right. Not quite so picaresque as some earlier picaresque, but it's basically one damn thing after another. And he himself says there's no plot to it. There's no plot to it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a kind of, you know, string of events that you follow, but that's not a plot, you know. In fact, most of the novels he writes don't have plots. Huck being an exception.
Which I have always thought of as the first American road novel, even if it was a river.
Well, that's understandable.
Yeah.
And it really is close to being... I mean, Mark Twain's basic talents are not that of a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
They're really that of a journalist and of a humorist whose forms have to be almost by nature brief. In the autobiography, he remembers writing Tom Sawyer. And coming to, he says, page 4, and we think it's actually page 500, and you can't write anymore. The book stops, he says. So I put it away, and a couple of years, it's actually about 6 or 8 months later, he pulls it out of the pigeonhole, and everything, you know, goes forward again. And he says, that's when I discovered that when I, you know, the book stops writing itself, if I put it away, the unconscious cerebration, which takes place while that's going on, it enables me, you know, the tank, he calls it the tank. The tank has run dry, now the tank can fill up again, and you can go on writing. We think that he gets to a point, you know, and he starts roughing it, and writes maybe 10, 12 chapters, and he can't go on. But he's kind of panicked about it. So he does all kinds of things like giving himself impossible deadlines and doing various other things to distract him. He clearly doesn't know how to deal with it. And that's really, he says, not until Tom Sawyer, that he learned, you know, to basically live with this. And so you wind up with someone who has a dozen projects going at any one time.
I was also fascinated to see that he was a word counter like many writers.
Oh.
He knew per day.
Per day.
And set a goal. And
that's good.
And I hear this from many, from Jack London or many of the writers we've met with.
I think, I mean, my own guess is that that's a way of, you know, giving yourself a fairly concrete sort of grasp of whether you're moving along or not.
Right.
He liked, you know, he would get into periods where he would write, you know, numerous pages, and he'd write letters saying, I wrote 16 this way, right, and 17 that way, and 32 that way. And yes, that's part of the success mode. When he's in the, you know, when he's really grooving, he can pile up the pages at a remarkable rate. But I think he also, you referred to the composition in the little studio, the basically it's a octagonal house that's just a little higher up from the house that he's living in, but they are all on top of a hill in Elmira. So in the absence of air conditioning, it was a good place to write in the summer because the windows were free. And he would literally go up there in the morning after breakfast and stay and then come down around 4, skip lunch, didn't want to eat. And depending on what he was working on, he would read the result of that to his family. Right. So he'd get a kind of immediate feedback on stuff. But it also, I think it shows, you know, he realizes that unless he gives himself a pattern, he's not gonna make progress.
Now, Robert, could you talk briefly about, or just tell the story about, Mark Twain's adoption of new technology in writing? I mean, we're talking, he bought the first Macintosh computer. No, it wasn't a Macintosh.
No, it wasn't. It was just a very inadequate kind of typewriter. Well, I think you just have to say that Mark Twain was fascinated by any kind of technology especially that would help him write. So, when he gets a chance to use a typewriter, yes, he uses a typewriter.
Dictaphone?
Now, it doesn't really... any kind of dictation. I mean, when Edison creates a dictaphone, he uses that.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, he has his reservations about it. He says, you know, the machine doesn't respond to what I'm saying. So there's no, it's just like, you know, it's not good enough. And that's why, in fact, it takes him a while to get to really dictating the autobiography, because he has to find someone who's good at getting the copyright and who can react,
mm-hmm,
who can smile, and show that they are amused by what he's saying. In any case, so the dictaphone, the typewriter, he actually owns a typewriter at several periods in his life, and he can type, but it really doesn't appeal to him. I think actually he must have gotten some kind of physical pleasure out of using that pen, because his handwriting is one of the clearest in the world, and you can find documents from the beginning to the end that are just beautifully written. And they're not feminine in that, you know, not a curlicues, but they're just very plain style, very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, of course, the arch example is his interest in the automatic typesetter. I mean, everyone knew that typesetting would be automated. Everyone knew. And there must have been 200 attempts out there when he starts to kind of invest money in the page typesetter. And he's absolutely fascinated by the idea that this could be done easily, right? That you could, instead of having to sit there and, you know, put little pieces of thought, that it can be done just by typing, and that it can be justified by typing. And that's one of the things the page machine does that I don't think the Linotype did. I think you had to kind of hand justify each line, and then would cast it, and right. So forth and so on. So, I mean, there's no question in my mind that he's acting out, you know, a deep experience he's had with typesetting in a way that he thinks, well, it may well make him a lot of money, but it's also just fascinating that it can be done. You know? Yeah. So I would say if he were alive today, he certainly would own 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 computers, and he would be on he'd have all the Apple stuff.
And, yeah.
You know, he loved it. No question about it.
Yeah.
Telephone, another one. I mean, you know, first guy to get a telephone in Hartford. You know?
Right.
Even though it only goes between his house and the newspaper. You know, I mean, and you know, it's a pretty crude thing at the time. You know, they couldn't. Your phone didn't work at night because they had no way of protecting the line from the current that went through to light the streets. You get all kinds of static, and so when they finally figure out that, I mean, and bury it, you know, then it gets a little bit better. But in his lifetime, you know, it goes from about 1885 to, well, when he's in New York, I mean, the phone is actually a pretty good instrument. He actually communicates with it, and, you know, he keeps people's numbers. And that. So, you know, he's any technology like that that he can put up with. Now, he may complain about it.
Right.
And he did complain about it.
Nothing was sacred.
No, absolutely not. You know, he says basically, you know, hope everyone goes to heaven except the guy who invented the telephone.
Right. Right. I just have to ask, either you, Robert Hurst, or you as the surrogate for Mark Twain, what kind of advice they would have, you would have, for aspiring writers? Now, Twain must have had one of those quips or anecdotes that...
Well, one of the things he says to these people who write him and ask him for help is that writing is not different from other trades. An apprenticeship is necessary. And apprenticeship has to be generally served without pay, or at least at very low pay. And so I think his advice would be basically keep at it and realize that you're still at the learning stage and keep trying. And don't ask for people like me or to accelerate you to the heights. You know, you do it the same way we did, one step at a time. And if you're, I mean, he had a great faith, I think, in the judgment of what he calls the great reading public. And this basically, that's the only judgment that matters. You know, if they think if it's okay, then it's okay.
And
it doesn't matter what I think or you think.
Yeah.
It's what they think. If you're writing for the public, that's what they think that matters. So I think he would make that kind of advice. Say basically, keep at it.
Fantastic.
Don't be impatient with your apprenticeship. Take your time. Some apprenticeships like his will be much longer than others. And of course, he has, you know, a life earlier on that's full, as he says, is filled with apprenticeships. You know, I mean, not just writing. So it took him a long time. I mean, he doesn't decide in San Francisco to be, you know, to make something out of his talent as a writer until he's 30 years old. And in a time when basically life expectancy was maybe 55 and max, that's quite late.
Yeah. Right?
He's not married. You know, he's really pushed his adolescence, you know, fairly far out there. So don't be impatient.
Well, it occurs to me that I forgot to open up the obvious, most important thing to you. You're at the center of the universe of letters in America right now with the introduction of the autobiography. And you've got volumes 2 and 3 still awaiting. Any comments you want to make about...
Well, let's be clear. I'm not the editor of the autobiography.
Right.
I work with people who are the genius editors who figured that whole thing out and did it, and I'm just a kind of spectator. You know, I'm the Darth Vader who sits in the corner office and says, I like this and I don't like that. You know? it's very exciting for us because in general we're doing a scholarly edition, and the notion that a book could sell more than 2,000 copies, one of our books.
You've got a bestseller.
Oh, we had a bestseller. We were on the New York Times bestseller list for 24 weeks.
Yeah.
This is a new world for us. This is we're not accustomed to this, and in many ways we don't know what to think about it. But we think I think that what you're seeing is the kind of emergence of what Mark Twain called his submerged audience, an audience that was faithful to his readings, that read everything he published, but that was unknown to him personally. He never met him, but they buy lots and lots of books. And even though we thought we knew Mark Twain was fairly popular, we had no idea that his autobiography would sell 500,000 copies. I mean, it's beyond our ken. So we're still trying to get used to it, and also just to understand it a little bit better than we do.
It's exciting.
Yes, it is. Very exciting.
Dynamite job you guys did.
Well, I'm glad.
Three thumbs up to you.
Well, I'll tell the editors, you think that's great. Because I do too. I passed it. I said, yeah, that's okay. We can publish that. That's the big job right here, saying okay.
Thank you, Robert.
You're very welcome.
It's really wonderful.
Good.